Hi folks, welcome from the Harvard Graduate School of Education. My name is Dominic Rollins and I serve as a Senior Diversity and Inclusion Officer. I'm here with John Wilson, former Morehouse College President and also our President in Residence here at HGSC. We're in our second installment of Walking the Talk, an honest conversation about diversity and inclusion. John and I today are going to engage about what does it mean to lead diversity and inclusion efforts, particularly in a higher education space. I imagine our conversation will go other places too. Let's get started. So John, I'm wondering, what have you learned about leading diversity and inclusion efforts in higher education?
Liberated.
What I've learned is, I think diversity and inclusion, you kind of live it. And it's easier if you have an open attitude, a trusting attitude. Most of the times when there's difficulty in diversity and inclusion, it's because of the prejudices that people bring to situations.
Yeah.
When if you are more open about those things and presume common ground when you're interacting with people, no matter who they are, you're less likely to run into some of the common problems you see in this realm.
Yeah. In my work, I'm often trying to help people to unlearn prejudices. Like, no one comes into the world born with prejudices.
Right.
Can you tell me a little bit about maybe how you've unlearned some of your prejudices, if you've had any?
Well, I didn't so much unlearn them as I did early on establish a posture for myself about the whole issue of difference.
Okay.
For instance, a lot of my viewpoint about it comes from my biography because we lived in inner city Philadelphia initially, and then we moved out to predominantly white suburbs.
Uh-huh.
And so all of a sudden, I was the other.
Okay.
I was different. And I had a choice at that point. I could either wall myself off from people who are different from me and harden myself in this posture of being the other.
Yep.
Or I could embrace, be open to it. And I think that the thing that I did was I made the choice. This largely stems from the way I was raised. My parents taught me that the world is yours.
Yeah.
You're at home in the world. And I got reinforced when I went to Morehouse. And if you're at home in the world and the world is yours, then you're not the other.
Yeah.
And you tend not to other people.
Yeah. I think one of the hard things in the current climate is that you have people who feel excluded, they feel wronged, and as a result, they can sometimes show up and then perpetuate exclusion. There's almost a cycle. I mean, a good coach and mentor of mine says that, like, hurt people hurt people.
Yeah.
And it's something that's really hard to break through. You have any thoughts there?
Well, I think the problem in most cases is fear.
Okay.
Hurt people are fearful.
Yeah.
That they're going to be hurt again.
Yeah.
And so as a defense mechanism, they hurt other people to keep themselves walled off.
Yep.
I think fear is the most dominant emotion in life.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and working with African American males, both in youth programs here in the Boston area when I lived here for a while, and then all the way to the pinnacle that is working with African American males as president of Morehouse College, the barrier in most people's in most of the minds and hearts and spirits of young men was fear. And if you could get to that fear, help them identify it, and work through it, then you can position them with a different posture in the world.
Yep.
And then you begin to treat other people in a different way when you're not operating out of fear.
Sure.
Fear is just a a seriously complicating factor for not just African-American males, but all people.
Yeah.
And I think it's at the root of those who have issues with diversity. They fear the other.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's going on most of the time.
You know, in that response, you mentioned sort of educating and being with African-American males. And I most certainly would be remiss to not ask sort of a direct and poignant question about educating African-American males, because we've been in a sort of a black male crisis in the U.S. for years. You've had an opportunity to think long and hard on this and serve at the helm of an institution that is all about educating African-American males.
Yep.
What's up with...
Well, look, I one of the ways that we defined the challenge, think about this, Dominic. Every year in this country, there are roughly 320,000 African-American boys starting ninth grade.
Yep.
And at the same time, every year in this country, there are roughly 160,000 finishing 12th grade. So we lose half between ninth and 12th grade, all right? Of the 160,000 who finish 12th grade in this country, only 50,000 attend a four-year college. And of the 50,000 who attend a four-year college, only 8,000 get the kind of grades and scores that'll get them in moderately competitive places.
Yep.
So going from 320,000 to 8,000 who have the best chance at being ready for this economy,
yep,
ready for this society, That defines the crisis right there,
yeah,
right? And what you see in a lot of that erosion, that pipeline, not leakage, but just pipeline breakage, is fear of underperforming,
yeah,
and fear of failure,
yeah,
on the part of a lot of people. And again, I go back to that fear issue. We have to solve that crisis. We have to do other things that will intervene and change those numbers dramatically, because I do think it is a national crisis.
Yeah. You know, part of what you're saying for me has me thinking that there's a lot of responsibility on the person to sort of show up in a particular way.
Yeah.
And I'm often pushing people to think about like the system, mm-hmm, right? So how does our systems, whether it's the higher ed system, education system broadly, I mean, even the world, how does the world need to change to be more inclusive of black men, to be more inclusive of trans people, to be more inclusive of women, folks with disability? I mean, I think we all can make a choice to show up differently, to navigate, and it also seems like the system should probably change.
Yeah. Yeah, so the way I like to frame that issue is we have a human capital problem,
okay,
worldwide, but especially in this country.
Yep.
And, you know, we don't have time for hate. I remember I spent a number of years of my life in Atlanta, and Maynard Jackson, a good Morehouse man, former mayor of Atlanta, said, "We are a city too busy to hate," right? So he was trying to trump the differences that many people saw between each other and that were like barriers by saying, look, we have too much good work to do.
Yeah.
Have time, me getting in your way, you getting in mine because you don't like my color or the way I dress.
Yeah.
There's too much good work to do to make America heal some of the differences that we have here, to cause America to remain competitive and be number one again in the world. I was in the Obama administration. We had that as a cause as well. We want to be the most educated and prepared society in the world. We were not number one. We haven't been number one since 1995.
Yep.
And so in order to be number one again, we have to be about the business of enhancing our human capital.
Yep.
And a lot of that can only happen if we get rid of some of the differences and prejudices and just be about the business of creating a better country.
Yeah, that, you know, part of that dovetails into what I think about for folks, ideas like heterogeneous teams are more innovative, right? To really help folks understand that the most innovative outcome you're going to get requires there to be difference, and that's a rationale for being able to work across difference, right? That actually creativity that we're often looking for is going to be engendered by being with people that are different than necessarily being with folks that are similar. I mean, part of this is connected to the many diversity rationales that exist for why we are aspiring to do difference and include difference. Yeah. As you think about it in a education space, what has been the reason you've offered your teams for why diversity matters?
It's basically what you said. I mean, the best way to find out how much it matters and how effective it can be is to try it.
Yeah.
I mean, experiment. My wife and I lived and worked at MIT. We were on campus the whole time. A lot of Asian students, a lot of white American students, and some minorities. And diversity was just a kind of natural thing. Everywhere you went, there it was. And basically, the segregation that tends to occur is almost illogical.
Sure.
And so, and when you're exposed to different groups, then you see an illustration of that that notion that you just put forward, the notion that there's more creativity and innovation when you have people from various backgrounds, various walks of life. And once you experience that one time or a few times, then you get it.
Yeah.
You get the deficiencies and the problems, shortcomings of sameness all the time.
Yeah.
And I, you know, with a role like yours here at the Ed School, I think one of the things that can benefit a lot of people is to try to understand what success looks like.
Yep.
I mean, you have to think about your role in diversity here, at least sometimes in terms of, okay, at some point, I'm going to be so effective in my role that
no
my job will
me.
No longer
right.
be necessary. Right. So what does success look like as you work it with this environment?
For me, success looks like us being able to be in process. I don't think that we arrive to a state and be done, but rather we've established enough of community and enough relationship where anytime we have to meet a need, we can meet it. So sometimes people ask me the question of like, so when will you know you have enough minoritized folks as faculty, students, and staff? Like, when will you be done with representation? Or when will you have all the practices right that are inclusive? And I say, it's a moving target because it's dependent on our community. And so can our community be in a process to get what they need to be able to thrive? Mm-hmm. You know, I will no longer need a job when you and I work at the Ed School and we have a bump in a conversation and we also have the skills to move through that bump in the conversation that could have been as a result of our identities.
Yeah.
But that bump will always be there, right? Or I will no longer sort of need a job here when we have conversations about who's in our classrooms, like the representation, and we say, do we need to shift the representation? Like, should we consider who else is here? Like, how do we consider it when we actually are good at asking ourselves those questions and then doing something about it? But for me, there's no arrival point, but rather there's skills and an analysis around what inclusion and equity looks like, and community members can get the place to engage with that. And when we get there, then I don't have to build the capacity for folks to do it, because they themselves would be doing it.
I see that.
For folks that are just joining us, we're in the second installment of Walking the Talk, HGSE's usable knowledge piece, where we're having honest conversations about diversity and inclusion in education. Today, I'm joined by John Wilson, former Morehouse College president and HGSE president in residence. So, John, you have worked in a lot of different contexts. So, Ivy institution, think about MIT there. You've been in a minority serving institution, think about Morehouse. You also have had this White House initiative on historic Black colleges and universities. when you think about these different contexts, what would you say about doing diversity and inclusion? I mean, context often is shaping this, and people have to be aware of it. You've led efforts where diversity matters in different contexts.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, I think, you know, those are very different environments. And at Morehouse, it was a different approach. It wasn't, obviously, not so much racial diversity, but diversity of different types, different gender identities.
Yeah.
And what you have to do is lead in this sense and model where you want people to go. So,
yep.
Morehouse, it's interesting, not many people know this, but a few years before I arrived, I think it was in 07, the valedictorian at Morehouse was a white student, Josh Packwood. And I met with Josh, who's now an investor in New York, 3 or 4 times as president. And he is as much a Morehouse man as some of my other classmates, including Jay Johnson and Spike Lee. I mean, Josh Packwood is just a solid Morehouse guy. So there's something universal about what we were doing at Morehouse that I think is at the heart of diversity, where you can have people, it wasn't race specific, the way we want you to move through the world, but it was open. Here now at Harvard, which is similar to MIT on these issues, I'm president in residence here, but I'm also an overseer.
Yeah.
And I'm so drawn to what Drew Faust is doing. She doesn't call it diversity, but it is inclusion and belonging.
Yep.
And basically that means we're on a mission to ensure that all students who experience Harvard, who graduate from Harvard, feel as if it belongs to them as much as it belongs to anybody else.
Yep.
And I remember when I was a grad student here, having just come from the Morehouse experience, where I loved Morehouse.
Yeah.
But I came here and I saw a lot of the students, especially the women and minorities, feeling something more akin to loathing rather than loving.
Sure.
And I believe that this mission that Drew Faust is on to advance inclusion and belonging here among all Harvard students, when we realize that at Harvard, that the greatness of Harvard will be enhanced. A lot of people think it's as great as it can be already. I don't think that's ever true.
Yeah.
I don't think you can ever be totally there, but that is a holy grail right there.
Yeah.
Get other people feeling a sense that the place is theirs as much as it is anybody else's. Hmm. All right.
I imagine that our viewers watching might suspect that 2 black men on camera in this conversation may only stay in the race space. And honestly, in some places, when you say diversity, the first thing that people think about is race.
Right.
And they don't go anywhere else.
Right.
I'm curious for you, what's been a learning or insight about other social identities as you think about doing diversity and inclusion?
Take sexual preference, for instance. I think the main challenge there is that too many people, again, bring these presumptive viewpoints about the other.
Yeah.
There may be some fear there. There is some judgment there.
Yep.
I have found that sexual preference,
and I might go with
sexual orientation. As I thought about that whole issue as President Morehouse, I insisted your sexual orientation has nothing to do with the greatness to which we want you to aspire.
Sure.
That it's almost beside the point of where we want you to go.
Yep.
to make us proud to have educated you.
Yeah.
All right? So I, when you think about it, it should not be the barrier that it is for so many people in terms of relating to others.
Yeah.
It should not be what it is. But you have to think about it if you're going to get to that point of maturity and your viewpoint about it. You have to think about it in terms of the greatness of any human being, where they are now, in the educational terms, how we want them to to develop. I don't know if you, in your position, see that the issues that come up regarding sexual orientation as charged as you see the racial conflicts when they come
up. So this is a place where, like, context matters.
Yeah.
And being in the state of Massachusetts, one of the first to legalize at the state level same-sex marriage, being then more specifically in Cambridge, which at times can feel pretty liberal around sexual orientation, I haven't found that sexual orientation in this context matters in the same way that race does. I find that folks that are racially minoritized, so people of color in this context, experience more bumps than do LGB folk. And I purposely leave off the T in transgender folk because that part of gender identity expression looks and feels different than I think explicitly sexual orientation. And so it's interesting because I think context and where you are, I mean, actually how I was asking you about the different places you've worked, but also physical location is really mattering in terms of what social identities folks are wrestling with or experiencing, again, the bumps with.
Yeah.
Folks, we're just joining in. We are rounding out our second conversation in the Walking the Talk series with former Morehouse College president, John Wilson, who also is currently serving as HGSE's president in residence. So, John, as we get to our sort of last segment of the conversation, I know I have a lot of educators watching. Those who could likely use some sage advice in a time when race conversations, identity conversations are up in the world. I know you opened a little bit about sort of working one's own prejudices, sort of working that internal stuff. I'm wondering what other advice you might give to educators sort of on the ground finding themselves in the middle of these tensions and conversations.
I'll just speak as a lifelong educator, career long, but you know, growing up as mom a teacher, dad a preacher, you know, I was always in this conversation about, you know, being the best you can be.
Yep.
And that's what I've always tended to centralize, that the human potential, awakening somebody's potential.
Yep.
There was a phrase that that I made good use of as President Morehouse, a quote from Mark Twain. Mark Twain said, "The two most important days in your life are the day you're born and the day you find out why." Right?
Yeah.
So everybody has this, not everybody has the why day, that second day. And being an educator is being in the business of awakening people to their purpose in life.
Yeah.
Of giving them or having something to do with why they finally experience their second day.
Yep.
When you think about things that way, when you see life that way, prejudice and hate and all these other things just get so trivialized. They just are rendered irrelevant.
Sure.
Because this is about getting human potential to awaken in someone so that they can discover for themselves why they were born.
Yeah.
and I had my second day on the campus of Morehouse College. I think educational institutions can aspire to be second day institutions, where people are more likely to have their second day. I think that is the heart of the matter. And if we get good at that, structuring an undergraduate or graduate experience so well that a disproportionately high number of people have their second day, then I think we're really doing a great thing for this world. That's what it's about to me.
I like that. I agree with that. And what I would add to that is having folks to be able to understand that in their context and within the systems. And, you know, because it's one thing to sort of realize potential and realize it, I think, for yourself, sort of independently and individually. And it's another to realize potential and be able to hold how the world works, right? Because there is something currently unique about how you and I might have to navigate this world that other people that don't inhabit this body have to traverse when they navigate. And so I want folks to have their second day and have their second day in context of understanding this place so that you actually can realize the potential. Because if you don't, you know, you might be hard pressed to make, you know, some of the moves that you need to make without a full understanding of how it all is working.
Yeah. And by the way, people have had their second day. Mm-hmm. People who you can be around not too long and understand that this person knows why they're here.
Yeah.
They're less likely. As a matter of fact, I'd be shocked if they hate and carry prejudice because they don't have time for it.
No.
They don't have time for it.
No. They indeed are on their path.
That's right. That's right.
Folks, I think that does it for us. The second day conversation seems like a good time to end the second installment of Walking the Talk. Thanks so much for joining in. John, thanks for being in conversation with us.
Thank you.
And stay tuned for the next one. Bye.